This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vianne, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of September 17th, here are some top stories. The arrest of a patient in Arizona is threatening to upend the state's medical marijuana industry. It's a case likely headed to the Arizona Supreme Court. In the second part of our series, KJZZ's Will Stone looks at how the case began.
Even as Rodney Jones was being sentenced to prison, the judge wasn't quite sure what to make of his case. "Like everyone else, I don't know what the answer is," the Superior Court judge told him. He'd been arrested on drug charges, except the narcotic was a small amount of marijuana oil in a jar, and Jones, a medical marijuana cardholder. And he's not the only patient who's faced prosecution.
"It looks like I have a plea in this case."
The woman was appearing in a Prescott court a few months after she, too, was arrested for having oil made from resin of the cannabis plant.
"So you had possession of something that you purchased at a
dispensary. Yes.
With a valid medical marijuana card."
"Yes."
Eventually, the prosecutor interrupts.
"The issue is that she had marijuana wax, which is a narcotic drug and not covered by the Arizona Medical Marijuana Act."
The judge asks if the dispensary is also in trouble.
"The distributor is not being prosecuted for selling to you."
"None of the dispensary."
The judge pauses. And the prosecutor explains the woman may face felony charges if she doesn't plead guilty to a misdemeanor instead. She takes the plea. An hour later, another medical marijuana cardholder is called up on the same charges. "It's a situation that's played out in Yavapai County for years," says Jared Keenan.
"They routinely go after qualifying patients who use marijuana extracts."
Keenan was a public defender in the county and now works for the American Civil Liberties Union.
"Threatening people with serious felony charges for possessing something that they purchased from a state-licensed dispensary is really not the way that the police system is supposed to be working.
At issue, do these cannabis extracts, which go into everything from edibles to vape pens, count as medical marijuana? Recently, an appeals court ruled no, they don't, and upheld the conviction of Rodney Jones. In doing so, they raised the specter of this happening across Arizona.
"Theoretically, any patient using any form of marijuana other than the leafy flower that you smoke could be subject to felony charges."
That crackdown hasn't come to Maricopa County yet, according to the top prosecutor's office, which is waiting to hear from the state Supreme Court. Likewise, state health officials haven't told dispensaries to stop carrying the products. But the Yavapai County attorney, Sheila Polk, one of Arizona's staunchest foes of marijuana, says this is a policy she's always enforced.
"I don't know where the source of confusion would come. We have a Court of Appeals opinion that is clear. There's not been a change here in how we do business."
Her argument against extracts hinges on the fact that Arizona's medical marijuana law doesn't explicitly mention them. Meanwhile, the criminal code does. It even assigns a harsher penalty for cannabis oil than marijuana flower. Many lawyers disagree with this argument, so have some lower courts. But Polk believes voters did not want these extracts when they passed medical marijuana in 2010.
"They weren't contemplating that manufacturers would be extracting one chemical from that marijuana plant to make this, you know, mind-blowing product that is addictive."
She's talking specifically about products with high concentrations of THC, the psychoactive cannabinoid, not the other compound, CBD, used to treat things like epilepsy or chronic pain. She says it's not clear that's illegal for patients and compares it to the difference between morphine and heroin.
"From the plant, you can extract something that can have medicinal use, but you can also extract something that is terribly destructive."
But the woman in Prescott Court, the one we heard earlier, told the judge that's what she had, CBD.
"On the police report, it says CBD."
All this concern over potent extracts misses the whole point of medical marijuana, says plant biologist Hope Jones.
"The point is to come up with something in a personalized medical way that works for us. And it might not be a baby aspirin, it might be more of an Advil."
Jones is a consultant for cannabis growers in Arizona, not related to Rodney Jones. She says this distinction between the resin and the actual flower misunderstands the biology of the plant.
"The resin is a part of the flower. The resin, you don't make resin by just separating something from the flower and then process resin.
In fact, that resin, what contains the active ingredients, is stored in small crystals called trichomes. Those are being separated from the plant all the time, even if you're just handling the flower.
The trichomes are breaking and the resin then is getting out of the trichome and sticking to your hands.
So Jones says by the court's logic, anytime those trichomes are separated or extracted, you're making a narcotic.
I mean, it is impossible to go in and buy a flower that has not had any trichomes break off and be in that container.
After she explained this to a judge in Navajo County, she says he dismissed the case. But this science did not come up in the recent appeals court ruling, which takes precedence. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From the Fronteras Desk, here's reporter Matt Casey and host Lauren Gilger.
A former employee of Southwest Key Programs has been convicted of sex crimes against the undocumented kids he once served. On Friday, a jury found 25-year-old Levion Pacheco guilty of 10 charges after a short trial in federal court. For more on this, we are joined by KJZZ's Matthew Casey, who has been following the recent allegations against workers for the Texas-based nonprofit that has received more than $500 million in federal funding just this year. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Lauren.
So first, tell us, when and where did these crimes occur?
They took place between August 2016 and July 2017. We learned about them about a month ago, at the beginning of August, about a month before Mr. Pacheco's trial started, when ProPublica exposed the case. They all happened at the Southwest Key Casa Cocapelli shelter in Mesa, where Pacheco was in charge of looking after immigrant kids. He was found guilty of sexually abusing 7 teenage boys. The federal government closed the facility for a little while after Pacheco was arrested last year. It is now back up and running and can hold about 300 kids.
What do we know about these 7 victims?
Not much, other than they're teenage boys who face potential deportation. I'm told that when the first allegation against Pacheco came out, it sort of opened the floodgates and a bunch more kids came forward. I spoke with a psychologist who works with victims of sex crimes, and she says that's really not uncommon, especially on boys. And the example that she gave was the Jerry Sandusky case up at Penn State, where, you know, victims were silent for years.
So what has Southwest Key's reaction been to this verdict against Pacheco?
They say that they felt grief, you know, that abuse occurred in their facility, but they found comfort in the fact that justice had been served. And they said that testimony during the 7-day trial showed that they had acted immediately when they found out about the first allegation against Pacheco. They suspended him and called police.
So obviously this has led to calls for more oversight. This was a federal contractor, after all, is a federal contractor.
Correct. So around the time Pacheco's story came to light, the State Health Department did inspections of all 13 Southwest Key facilities in Arizona. They found some minor problems, which they plan to fine Southwest Key for, but overall the report sent to Governor Ducey says Southwest Key is operating legally. The state was able to secure some more oversight in the coming year, but there are critics who say it doesn't go far enough. Now, if Arizona wants more oversight beyond the licensing, child behavioral health licensing that it gives to Southwest Key to operate, it's going to have to pass a law. But really, the biggest oversight of Southwest Key comes from the federal government. As you mentioned, Southwest Key is federally contracted, and that comes through the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is under the Department of Health and Human Services. And the Department of Health and Human Services has its own investigative arm that is currently doing a nationwide review of all shelters that hold undocumented kids.
All right, so what is next, Matt?
Well, we're going to see what happens with the federal investigation. You know, those things can move slow, but the inspector general, so to speak, is usually quite thorough. Pacheco is scheduled to be sentenced in early December. And then there's also another sex crimes case against a former Southwest Key worker, Fernando Negrete, who worked at the Phoenix facility where you'll remember that First Lady Melania Trump visited in June. Mm-hmm. He's accused of child molestation, sexual abuse, and assault on a child in connection with an alleged incident that occurred the night before the First Lady came to town. Negrete's case is in Maricopa County Superior Court as opposed to federal court where Pacheco's case was, and Negrete has pleaded not guilty.
All right, that's KJZZ's Matthew Casey. Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you, Lauren.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show. Here's co-host Steve Goldstein.
A major cash investment, $1 billion made via the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, is intended to provide the needed capital allowing Lucid Motors to complete its Arizona manufacturing facility. The long-awaited high-performance electric car, the Lucid Air, is scheduled to be launched commercially in 2020. Joining us now to talk about what this means for the electric car industry is Andrew Hawkins, who's been writing about this for The Verge. Andrew, good to talk with you. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, sure. Happy to be here.
How big a deal is this? What does this do as far as Lucid's place overall in this competitive industry?
Well, I think it's a really big deal, especially when you consider that for a very long time, this sort of segment of the market has been dominated entirely by Tesla. And now we're starting to see a lot of the major automakers making electric cars, trying to compete with Tesla. And we're starting to see some of these sort of smaller startups starting to make major moves as well. And Lucid is certainly one of the first to come out of the gates with this funding announcement. With the Saudi Public Investment Fund. It's a really big deal. It's really going to send them on the path towards building their factory in Arizona, as well as, like you said, producing their first electric vehicle.
If you can put this into perspective for us, obviously $1 billion sounds like a tremendous amount of money. In this industry, how far will that go?
This is a great question, and I don't think it will go as far as probably a lot of people think. I think that we're already starting to see some questions raised by experts and sort of industry watchers who are sort of asking, you know, where's the next billion going to come from? If this vehicle is not going to be coming out for a number of years, it's obviously going to be a small sort of production volume. How are they going to sort of strategize and plan for the next steps if they want to sort of ramp up production and actually be a competitive player in this marketplace? We're starting to see luxury electric vehicles coming out from Audi and Mercedes, as well as a lot of the more major established automakers. You know, it's going to take a lot for a startup like this to really sort of play in a field like that. So while this is certainly a great first step for them, especially since they've been sort of keeping their head down and plugging away at this for a number of years now, I'm sure it's going to sort of raise the stakes for them and have them out looking for the next billion.
I'm glad you brought up the big dogs on the block because ultimately, I mean, obviously this is still a forming industry, but ultimately does it seem like the big players like GM, Mercedes, Ford, whatnot are going to have a built-in advantage there? And ultimately, is Lucid, is Tesla trying to do what they can to compete? Or is each company thinking again, we heard about Tesla trying to go private, is there a possibility if this succeeds that they really can compete? Or ultimately, is it more about, I don't know, merging, being bought out?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and we were seeing some conversations a few months back about whether or not Lucid was going to get bought by one of the more established OEMs. I think Ford was in the mix possibly as a potential company that would look to acquire Lucid. That never really played out, and I think now that Lucid's got this $1 billion in its checking account, they are probably hoping to, establish their own brand, their own name, start to build up a loyal fan base the way that Tesla has. An acquisition, I'm sure, is always something that a company like this is going to keep in the back of their minds. But I think that for now that they've secured this major investor, I think that they're going to want to sort of stay independent and build their loyal fan base the way that Tesla has and try to sort of follow that playbook as closely as possible.
As a journalist as well, you know how much we love crystal ball questions. So how competitive can electric cars be in the broader industry? And I even mean if we're talking about the next couple of decades.
So we sort of see the numbers, tracking the numbers, and they're slowly ticking up over the years. I think they've been going up a little bit more steadily than they have been in the past. But that said, gas prices are very cheap these days, and American, especially in the American market, people are very much interested in SUVs and trucks, and those tend to trend towards gas-burning vehicles. The electric vehicles that you see on the road today are typically sedans or smaller hatchback-type vehicles. But the ones that are sort of in the pipe, the ones that we see coming out, like I mentioned before, from Mercedes and Audi and some of the big players are trending towards a larger vehicle base, SUVs and the like of that. So I think that in the long run, if these cars can come out and market themselves to that segment of the population that are early adopters, they want to be seen as having sort of the latest high-tech gizmo, the things with all the touch screens and all the gadgets, those are going to be people that are going to be attracted to a vehicle like this. Now, whether or not that they can make a more mass-market vehicle like Tesla is trying to do right now with the Model 3, and we've seen the struggles that company has been undergoing right now, is a bigger question, and whether or not it can sort of penetrate into the sort of the broader population.
That is Andrew Hawkins, who writes about transportation for The Verge. Andrew, we appreciate the time. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
From the Business Desk, here's co-host Lauren Gilger from the show.
There is something comforting about home cooking, and even though a lot of restaurants advertise that their cooking is as good as your mother's, recent data shows that more Americans are staying in than they did a decade ago. Maybe it's the Netflix effect, maybe it's about the cost of eating out, maybe it's the popularity of Uber Eats, but one thing is clear, restaurants have a lot to compete with these days, according to our next guest. Darren Seifer is a food and beverage industry analyst for NPD Group, a leading market research group. And he says restaurants today have to create more than good food. They have to create an experience to get you in the door. I spoke with him more about it via Skype.
Restaurant usage peaked at around 2000. We saw around that time about 216 times a year is when the average American went out to restaurants. And it has come down steadily ever since that time. It's now down to about 185 times per year for the average consumer. Now, a lot has happened during that time. The millennial generation started to finish college and started entering the real world, but they were saddled with student debt like we've never seen before. And at that same time, around 2008, 2009, the recession really took its full grip. And so you have this whole group of people who are starting to enter the workforce, but they're not getting those high-paying jobs that they thought they were going to get. And so this generation that's actually in a life stage when they should be going out to restaurants more than any other group has stayed at home much more often than we thought that they would. Hmm. But while they're at home, they're discovering their kitchen sooner than we expected them to as well. They're getting a little bit more experimental than previous generations did at that age. The internet is at their fingertips. So basically, world cuisine is available to them nonstop. You know, it's not just about meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
So it's not just about using their kitchens more often, but they're also doing more things with them than we would have expected them to.
That's so interesting. So do you think, you said, you know, they have the internet at their fingertips, right? So that's unlimited information about how to learn how to do this stuff. But I wonder if there's also maybe like an Instagram effect here, right? Like food pictures are everywhere and you want to be a part of that culture.
Exactly. You know, even if you made the dish yourself, you want to be proud of it, brag about it. And so you kind of plate it nicely and make sure it goes up on Instagram. And of course, you use the right filter to make sure the colors come through at the same time.
So you said this is about cost, about, you know, millennials not making the kind of money they were expected to be making. Is it still true that it's a lot cheaper to eat at home?
It is cheaper to eat at home. And it is getting even cheaper in comparison to restaurants because restaurants have continued to take pricing, you know, whether it's labor costs or rent costs that are driving the cost of providing the services higher. Retail on the other side has been somewhat stagnant in their pricing. So the gap between going out to restaurants and staying home is actually starting to widen. So it is a much more cost effective to stay at home, even more so today than a few years ago.
I wonder, have like food delivery services, the Blue Aprons, the Hello Freshes of the world made a dent in this?
What those have done, they provided a level of convenience that consumers were seeking. So before they even came about, consumers were opting for more fresh foods in their homes. And well, those foods require more of us. Preparation, washing, chopping. What these services did was they answered the question that we have every single night, which is, what's for dinner? But it also saves them a trip to the grocery store while still allowing them to have fresh foods at home. Now, we are starting to see some changes in this dynamic. These meal kits are starting to pair up with retailers. Perhaps the subscription model is not as sustainable as they thought it once was. People like to think of what they're going to have for dinner more at the last minute versus planning it out in advance. So we're starting to see a tighter relationship with retailers, which gives the consumer still what they want, but they could do it when they want it.
Right. So we still see reports, though, of rising restaurant sales. What impact is, if at all, this shift having on the restaurant industry?
Well, we're seeing dollar sales increasing at restaurants, but again, that's a function of pricing.
So restaurants are raising their prices?
In many cases, they are, yes. Now, there are a few diamonds in the rough, if you will. The fast casual restaurants out there, such as your Paneras, your Chipotles, we see them having more traffic over the last few years. So there is some growth to be had in the restaurant world right now, but it's very few and far in between.
Sure, sure. So you mentioned fast casual, that's still doing well. But what about like the fast food industry versus higher end restaurants?
Well, there still seems to be a little bit of struggling going on in those areas. We've actually seen a lot of work in the last few years amongst big chains and full-scale restaurants to try and woo people back in. McDonald's is going through a very big revamping of all their stores. So they're changing the interior. They're making it more of a place where you could come and hang out. So they're trying to make the experience of going into these restaurants a little bit better than they were in the past. Mm-hmm. And that's really where consumers are trying to spend their dollars, is where can they get a good experience?
Hmm. So where do you see this headed as the millennial generation becomes, you know, parents, they become older adults? Is this going to stay the same?
Well, I think there are certain things that millennials are doing on a higher plane. And we just tend to we tend to do them more as we age. So, for example, millennials, as well as Gen Zs, by the way, consume more fresh foods than other generations did 10, 20 years ago. We should expect them to continue that. And so as they continue to do that in their homes, restaurants are also going to have to figure out, how do we provide that same service that you're looking for, the same taste quality and the flavor profiles that you're looking for as well. So I think that the pressure is just even greater for restaurants right now to appeal to what younger generations want.
So a difficult industry just got harder. All right.
Yes.
Darren Seifer is a food and beverage industry analyst for MPD Group. Darren, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this today.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Science Desk, here's KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbus.
The health, social, and economic costs of Alzheimer's disease among older Americans are projected to double by 2060, according to new research by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The number of Americans 65 and older with the disease is projected to grow from 5 million in 2014 to 13.9 million by 2060. As a percentage of the population, that's more than double over four decades. The study, in the journal Alzheimer's and Dementia, attributes the increase to people living longer. Alzheimer's is most prevalent among racial and ethnic groups that are projected to grow the fastest during that period. I'm Nicholas Gerbus in Phoenix.
And finally, from the Education Desk, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
A state senator says she's looking into changes to Arizona's laws on charter schools in an effort to make them more transparent and subject to the same financial laws as district schools. And Governor Doug Ducey says he's on board with that effort. This follows a series of investigations into charter schools, including several in which the operators of those schools have made a lot of money. Arizona Republic investigative reporter Craig Harris has been doing that reporting, and he joins us now. Hey, Craig.
Hey, good morning.
So what specifically would State Senator Kate Brophy McGee like to do, and what is Governor Ducey saying that he could be on board with?
Well, the state senator, who's actually in a very tight reelection race against the 2016 Teacher of the Year, Christine Marsh, what she wants to do is she would like to have the private management companies that aren't subject to public records law be disclose how they do their spending. And she also wants the charter schools to have the same kind of procurement and conflict of interest laws that govern district schools. And she would like to have more independence on the boards of charter schools. Right now, if you run a charter school, you can basically set the board up with your friends, relatives, anyone you want, and that doesn't provide a whole lot of independent oversight like district schools, which have their board directed by elected by the public.
So, Craig, you mentioned Senator Kate Brophy McGee's reelection race, and politics, of course, has to come into this. Legislative Democrats have been saying, yeah, these sound like great things. We've been proposing them for a few years now. I mean, this seems like it's been trying to be an issue at the Capitol, but it really hasn't been.
Well, absolutely. At least for the last 2-3 years, Democrats have proposed a variety of bills. And even this last session that just ended earlier this year, you know, they Democrats had a lot of bills that said, hey, we would like to have conflict of interest laws. We would like to have more procurement oversight. We want charter schools to play by the same rules. And one thing that we'd like them to do is that if charter schools are going to get a big, huge payday, some of the owners that have become millionaires, we want that approved by the charter board because we think the money should be going to educate kids, not making people millionaires. So the House and the Senate has proposed numerous bills earlier this year that would have done a lot of the same things or even tougher restrictions than what Senator McGee wants to do.
Craig, we've had you on the show to talk about this before, and one of the things that you said that struck me about this is that some of these things that you've been reporting on within the charter school system, if they were done in a district school, would be illegal, like you would go to jail. So I wonder, where do you think the tipping point was here, I guess, to get Republicans like Kate Brophy McGee, like Governor Ducey, on board?
Well, I think the first Republican with a lot of clout who came out to speak on this was Attorney General Mark Brnovich, and he came out right after our stories ran on Primavera's online charter school owner making $8.8 million. He was flabbergasted, and he came out and said, hey, we need some laws to change this because my hands are tied on going after some of these questionable charter school operators. Democrats said, well, wait a minute, Mr. Attorney General, you've had 4 years. Now all of a sudden you're getting concerned. But I do think, you know, the bottom line is Republicans control every statewide office. They've controlled the legislature for the last two decades. And so even if Democrats had proposals, they weren't going to go anywhere until Republicans got on board. And now you're seeing a conservative attorney general, moderate to conservative state senator with a lot of clout, the Republican candidate for superintendent of public instruction, all saying we need reform. Democrats say, hey, that's great. You're all kind of late to the party, but I think it's better late than never.
Well, so, Craig, given all of those folks who've come out and said, yes, we need to do something, does that – I mean, you've been doing this for a while now. I mean, does that give you a sense that maybe come January there will be some kind of change?
I think there will be, and if not, we'll hold them accountable to that. I think, you know, what's interesting with the governor, and he's a smart guy, you know, he took the Red for Ed folks right out from under them when they wanted their big raise, and at first he said, no, we don't have the money, and then after the, you know, all the teachers stormed the street and went on strike, he found a way to give them a big pay raise, which kind of took their issue away. The governor might be doing the same thing here. You know, just last month he said, well, I'm not really concerned about CEO pay when we asked him about the $8.8 million paid to the Primavera CEO, who, by the way, is a campaign contributor to the governor. And now I think after the litany of stories, not just by the Republic, but TV stations are starting to pick this up because it resonates with voters. People can understand that there's not enough money in the public school system, and when charter schools are generating millionaires, it makes a lot of people angry, and it makes voters angry. And there's a very big election coming up here in less than 2 months.
All right. That's Craig Harris with the Arizona Republic. Craig, thanks as always. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.